Accession number 4486, Reel 6.
Colonel King Clark, Reel 6. So, what was the general British attitude towards the Palestine Arab then at that time?
Well, I think you've got to keep in mind, when you ask that question, that the atmosphere, the general sort of world atmosphere, was quite different to what it is now. One was much less aware of the aspirations of say, Arabs or Jews, because of communications were much less widespread than they are now. Also, of course, as I said before, politically, the average person was really very, very backward. I never voted in a general election before the war. I think if you'd asked me the name of two members of the cabinet, I would not have had the slightest idea. And I don't think that I, for a moment, was any different to my fellow officers. They had no real interest in world affairs, because at that time world affairs seemed very stable. I mean, maybe there was a war going on, there was sniping going on the northwest frontier, or little troubles in Palestine, but really the world appeared to be very stable. It was obviously moving towards a high degree of instability, but at that time it seemed very stable, and the British were all over the world. I mean, when I flew out to Singapore, except for a short stop in Persia, I mean, I was on, I say, red territory. The British Empire was always marked red. I was in British territory the whole way, you see, and so you felt this sort of feeling. So when you were thinking of the Arabs, you weren't thinking consciously of the British attitude toward them. You just had a sort of feeling about them one way or another. And I think that towards the ordinary Arab in the village, it was a perfectly friendly attitude. And certainly, as I think I mentioned earlier, the Palestine police, I know, because I used to see quite a bit of them, and quite senior people in them, they said to me that they preferred dealing with the Arabs than they did with the Jews, and that they had many friends amongst the Arabs. And certainly, I mean, you could go to an Arab village and sit down with an Arab Mukhtar and drink coffee with him, and you wouldn't understand what he was saying. They'd be very polite and very courteous and show you in and show you out. They had a different sort of approach to life, certainly, though presumably they're the same race. But I can tell you one more story, if you like, suddenly come to my mind. I remember this was I walked into a village with my squad one day. One night, and somebody shot at me with a 12 ball from the top of a house when we were walking down a passage, and we were a bit annoyed about this, and us, and so we banged on some door and we said, "Where's the Mukhtar's house?" And we found his house, which is in the middle of the village, and it had a huge, great double door, about 12 foot across, with a bar on it, and we banged on the door, and a very, very frail, quavery voice said, "Who's there?" And I had a Jew with me who spoke Arabic, and I said, "Tell him it's the British Army. Tell him it's the British Army to open up, because we've been shot at." And he said, "No, I'm frightened. I'm not going to shoot. Not going to open up. And if you knock the door down, I'll shoot. I've got a gun here." So anyway, I thought we've got to get the door open, and not a very brave person myself, but I can't ask somebody else to kick it down. So I gave it a great boot with the flat of my foot, and it didn't open, but it opened about the third time, and I fell flat on my face, expecting a blast off at me, but in fact all there was this old man standing there shivering with fear inside.
Did he have a gun?
No, he didn't. And we went in and sat down, and we had a long chat with him and coffee with him, and eventually left. And I felt really sorry for him. And I think that we were shot at, because they had odd shotguns around the place, and exactly like the Jews, if somebody came too near and it sounded like an organized body, they may have thought that we were Arabs. In fact, I have an idea. He may have said that we thought they were not Arabs, Jews, terrorists or Jews coming to And they just, somebody fired off at us. Not as bad though as when we were leaving Ein Harod one night with Wingate, with the whole three night squads together. And as we, we left Ein Harod, we passed another very small new kibbutz that had just gone up. And they were very jittery, and they used to put these up in a day, you know. They used to, in some cases, sort of putting down another outpost, they'd put up, they'd, at first light, they'd go out with trucks full of stakes and barbed wire and things, and put up I remember them putting up one in the Jordan Valley in a day, and getting into it in a day, so that they wouldn't, because very often they were interfered with if they were staying overnight and the place was open, so they had to have security over the first night. But we passed a very new one, and we were about 10 yards away, I suppose, from the wall. Somebody fired two shots from a 12-bore shotgun in our general direction, and Wingate was extremely angry. He spoke Hebrew very well. Extremely angry. It turned out to be a woman guard, which didn't please him particularly either, who shot and blasted off at him. It was very dark as well that night, I remember. So that was one thing that Wingate... So,
could you, let's go on next to some general things about the special night squads. When you were going out on one of your patrols, what kind of gear would you wear and what equipment would you take with you?
Yeah. To begin with, we went out in army boots and we went out in army boots, and Wingate, if I remember rightly, had them, you know, those Phillips leather, rubber soles you get of it. Well, he had them soled with these rubber soles, so he wouldn't make a noise, which was quite a good idea as a start, because they're very heavy boots, though. And so that was, the clothing we wore was, we just wore slacks, shirt, and these ammunition boots with rubber soles, and a cap or not as you wanted, a hat or not as you wanted. I carried a pistol and a grenade and a pair of binoculars. I was given a pair of binoculars by the Jewish Agency, a marvellous pair of Zeiss 750 binoculars, which I had later had stolen, which is a great pity, because we had the case engraved from the Jewish Agency on the top, and I was a very valued possession. But anyway, he insisted on us carrying binoculars for night vision, because it improves night vision. And the corporal, my corporal, also carried a pistol and some grenades. I had two bombers who carried a pistol and a haversack with four or five 36 grenades in them. And the rest of the squad carried the ordinary number one rifle with a fixed bayonet, with a bayonet fixed all the time, which again, Wingate laid down. As the weeks and the months went by, or as time went by, it became obvious these boots were really clumsy, and so I went off to Haifa, and I think at the time I bought my Mauser to replace my pistol, fully automatic pistol, to replace my 45 Webley, that was the standard issue pistol in those days, army pistol. To replace that, I bought a dozen pairs of, hockey boots, or what sort of leisure shoes they call them nowadays, that sort of thing. They kept your ankle, and they had rubber soles, and the Americans wore them, particularly for baseball and volleyball, as I get in America. Got them in Haifa, and I issued these to my squad, and they were a great improvement because they were light and not so tiring and so on. But throughout, from then on, we all wore the same gear, just khaki shirt, khaki trousers, and either a hat or a cap if you wanted to, or none if you didn't. I always wore a cap. I always wore a Sam Brown because it held my pouch with my spare ammunition in. And I tucked my binoculars around underneath the back, and I walked with my Mauser under my right arm with the stock on it.
What insignia, if any, did you wear?
I just wore my peak cap, which was the cap that all officers wore in those days. a rather old one, with my regimental badge in the front. I mean, just an ordinary regimental, my cap, with a regimental Manchester Regiment fleur-de-lis on the front. And I think the Highbrook War, he wore a side cap, I remember now, and he wore his regimental badge on it. But there was no, one wouldn't have worried if the terrorists had discovered that you belonged to the Manchester Regiment or the Ulster Rifles. I mean, it didn't have any bearing on what was going on at all.
Did you black your faces or anything?
No, we didn't. No, we never did. Wingate never even suggested this, as far as I remember. And I can't ever remember doing it. No.
It never occurred to you that it might be useful?
Not really. I mean, I knew that it had been done in the First War. I knew the patrols had done this, but we never did this. But we used to do, something I haven't mentioned, we did these really long marches straight across country. I mean, you'd go 20 miles, maybe, walk from, say, one road, from a north to south road, cover an area, cover a distance of, say, 20 miles, to the next parallel road, or nearly there, with nothing in between, and the village maybe a few miles short of the next road which you were going to surround, or going to lay up around in the morning. And I never carried a compass, and I don't think Mike Grove or Barlow Breeden did either, and I navigated entirely by the stars. I had a map, I carried a torch as well, a map, which was nearly all contours, because there was very little else, and I would take a bearing on where we were going, a rough bearing, with just looking at it, north or west, and I'd get the North Star over my right shoulder or on my left front, and I just walk on that, and keeping a rough idea of where I was going from the map. An occasional feature should come to your record, rather like flying. I mean, I'd be working on a compass bearing and checking on the map as I went along, and it was amazing how we very seldom ever missed our destination using this method. And sometimes, I say, you would go very long. Well, 22 miles was an exceptional one, and that was a sort of circular tour we did, but the average one, I suppose, was 10 to 14, 15 miles, something like that. But sometimes it was absolutely pitch black. Other times, when the moon was high, of course, it was really, really bright, bright light. But that's quite an interesting point, this question of how we found these places.
What did you take with you in the way of food or water?
Oh, we carried a water bottle.
No food?
No. I'd forgotten the water bottle. We carried a water bottle. The great delight, of course, as months went by and it got terribly hot and steamy, we used to raid the watermelon fields around some of the villages. These great big green watermelons used to slice through them. And with their bayonets, I always carried a knife as well, and you suck these, and they were really marvellous. So you got terribly hot and terribly humid. And I say we used to get these boils, just come one after the other.
How did they come about?
What?
The boils.
I don't know. I think it was hair roots. I got them all in the succession on the arm, all up my arm. I think it was the hair roots getting infected. One would go, and you'd think, oh, thank goodness, it's swollen up on your arm, you know, you'd feel really unwell walking a long way like this. No antibiotics in, of course. I just used to put some dressings around them from the MO or the medical centre in the kibbutz, and then you'd go, and then about a week later you'd get another one, the same little area. They were very debilitating. But this was at the end, this was in the last month or so, when we knew it for a long time, because we were run down, and when it was very humid, this terrible humidity.
How often would you go out on these patrols at night?
Well, you'd probably do two longish ones in a week, and maybe go out locally another night. Something like that. You'd do an average of two planned ones by Wingate, latterly, in a week. and then you'd go out probably on your own, off your own bat, I think he says in his letters, you know, just have a quick sort of go out, really to keep your hand in there. If you, it's rather like lots of other activities that aren't always very pleasant, because we didn't like them in the end, you know, we got really pretty fed up with the, with them. Yeah, when are you going out again? And the troops, and the troops, the Jews and ourselves, you know, Lord, not again. And so it did get, it got very tiring towards the end. It's about twice a week, I suppose, would be the average, probably.
And
it doesn't seem very much, but that's... but there were plenty of other things to do in between, sort of keeping doing sort of training and shooting and just sort of odd administration, always seemed plenty to do in the way of administering them. Conferences, going to see Wingate and chatting over things and debriefing on things that had happened, mistakes we'd made and things like that.
So when you'd finish one of the patrols, you'd then sleep for several hours, would you, during the day?
Oh yes, when we got back, we'd get back, say we finished at 6 or 7 in the morning, probably about 9 in the morning, I suppose, before we sort of all got together again, we'd just go straight back and go to bed straight away, go just get head straight down. And we wouldn't do anything that day or the next day. You always have, I always remember the feeling when you woke up after this, you've been asleep, absolutely sort of really, really weary and completely relaxed and sort of dried out. And then probably be another day, and then you'd then message come from Wingate. Please come along to Einherod this evening, or whatever it is. For tea time today, that's all. And then no indication what it was about. And he'd say, get the three of us in, maybe a Jewish interpreter, and one of the senior Jews maybe in the squads there as well. He'd say, right, tonight, I've had information that there's a gang operating out of the village of wherever it is, and we're going to have a go at this one tonight. He was very incisive and very... I got to know him very well, but I didn't know then that Captain Ord Wingate was one day going to become a sort of world famous figure. I wouldn't have been surprised, but then again, I didn't know about these things. I didn't sort of think about things like that. I didn't know there was going to be a war. I thought of him as an odd character. I didn't like him, but I admired him tremendously.
Why didn't you like him?
Well, there's an awful difference between respecting a person and actually liking them, isn't there? I suppose because I felt he was too intense. He didn't laugh and joke enough. Small talk and the sort of ordinary fun. I was just a young, wild subaltern. And, you know, he didn't want to talk about the things that Mike Grove and I and Barbara Reed, and we could be together and we'd joke and laugh. You know, just like any young chaps. But he came in, the whole atmosphere changed. And he was very authoritative, too.
Was he a strict disciplinarian?
Very strict, yes. Yes. I remember one night we were going on a patrol and we weren't to start about 2 o'clock in the morning. And we moved from the colony we were living in, the kibbutz. We called them colonies, Jewish colonies, from the colony that we were in, Afikim. And I'd said to Amalan, we're off at 2, give me a shake about 1:30. And he said, right. But he didn't wake up either. And the next thing I knew, somebody came in and said, everybody out, they're all out there waiting to start, all 30 of them. Wingate. And I remember thinking, oh God, leaping up. I wasn't really in bed, I was lying on somewhere. Grabbed my gun and everything went out and Wingate, I approached Wingate. It was dark. In fact, it was the same night that we were shot at by the women, guards. And he said, Mr. King Clark, because in those days, you know, you didn't, if you're a second lieutenant or a lieutenant, you're not called to your face lieutenant, you're Mr. Mr. King Clark, do you realise that you've been keeping 3 officers and 30 men waiting for half an hour? In a loud voice, everybody heard. And I said, I'm very sorry, or something like that, and I was. And he mentioned again later, I remember. But he was very fair at the same time. And he had a good, he had a very good understanding of man management. There wasn't a word in those days, but of what is now called man management. And he was very aware of the need to take, and he was very, particularly the Jews, he was Jewish soldiers, he was very, very considerate of them. And he was very anxious that anybody who did well should come to the notice of the Jewish authorities, of the agency, and be, you know, I don't know whether they rewarded them in any way or not, but he was very anxious that it should be brought to their notice that they did well. He understood the niceties of command in that way. I suppose this... Sorry.
Did you, at any stage in Palestine, have to defend the oil pipelines passing across the country?
Well, yes. When we first arrived, it was probably the most popular form of sabotage as far as the terrorists were concerned. This is what they... it's their favourite target. And you used to see the glow in the sky from quite a distance very often of the, when you say New Zealand, all the pipelines gone up again. This was before I joined the Special Night Squad even. And when I joined the SNS, Wingate was very keen to stop this particular activity. The method that they employed was to bare a bit of the pipeline and put petrol or paraffin, more likely soaked rags, underneath, set them on fire, and they had a few armour-piercing rounds, and they would fire one of these from a short distance into the pipeline, the jet oil would go up and eventually ignite. Sometimes it didn't ignite, sometimes it did. But I remember being told that though this was not a good thing, that in fact the oil companies didn't really mind very much. It made necessarily no difference to their production or the amount of oil that eventually arrived in Haifa at the oil depot. And in some ways they would rather we just kept away from it and left it alone, because the very fact that we were trying to stop it only irritated encouraged the Arabs to do it again. And so in fact latterly it seemed to just fade away and they stopped doing it. It lost its popularity as far as they were concerned.
I think you said that Wingate on one occasion had a rather unorthodox method of attempting to put it out.
Well, we were just looking at this. We were standing around a group of us looking at this, the pipeline on fire. It wasn't a very big fire, actually. I don't think the hell they made it was very big, but it was burning away. And I think I suggested to him that there was a good method of putting out fires to hand, and he went forward and attempted to do so without much luck, though, without much success.
Did you have much to do with the Transjordan Frontier Force whilst you were in Palestine?
When we were in Afikim, I had a friend in the TGFF, a chap called Tinker, who was, I think, originally I forget which regiment, 12th Lancer, I think, or 9th Lancer, and he commanded the squadron at Sumac, or just by the RAF. Aerodrome at Sumac, because Sumac was on the border between Palestine and Jordan, Transjordan, as it then was. They didn't do very much as far as we could see. They had both mounted squadrons and armoured car squadrons. I think they were all Arabs, I think some of them came fairly far afield. I have sort of a vague feeling some of them were Kurds, and they recruited fairly widely, I think. The only time I remember them turning up at all was when we had a trouble in Tiberias itself. Somebody was killed, and they galloped up from Sumet to Tiberias rather dramatically and see if they could do anything. But we used to go to their... I used to go to their mess in... That was a picture of... I used to go to their mess occasionally in Sumet to see Tinker, who I knew. In fact, I kept in touch with him until after the war, and quite a long time. They were not really involved very much in the Palestine troubles.
Was that because cavalry was not very suited to the country?
I don't know. Maybe that, or maybe it was a policy. Maybe they were really in Transjordan, you see, again, which was... was it a mandate of Britain? Certainly, we had a... I think it was a mandate, probably, because, as you know, Amman was, which is the capital of Jordan. I was in the capital, Transjordan. We had an RAF squadron there, and no troops, but we had an RAF squadron there, which I think had a role of keeping an eye on the country.
What were relations like between the British Army and the Palestine Police?
On the whole, they were pretty good, I think. They had these... and again, I sort of scratch my memory about this, but they had police posts in most of the towns and larger villages. They, of course, had British, Arab, and Jewish police. Did they have Jewish police? Yes, they did have. I think they had all three. They had all three, I think, yes. I think that the quality of the Palestine policemen was perhaps not of the very highest. I know that a lot of them were people who had stayed on after the war, after the First War, or that sort of thing. Or who... I don't think that they were of the very highest quality of colonial police, for one reason or other. I think it's been a difficult place to recruit people for. They had some very good senior people, very good senior officers who seemed to fall foul sometimes of certain... I think they had a difficult job to do, to try and balance the army against... They were more interested in the civil population, because their job was to keep peace amongst the civil population. And I think that sometimes the army's actions impinged on what they thought was their job. And I think occasionally you got... but the one or two of them were very good and very diplomatic. One's like two or three I can think of. They were, on the whole, pretty good. And when searches and that went on, not as far as we were concerned, because we sort of... This is I think the police got rather annoyed with the special night squads, particularly using these Jewish kafirs or supernumerary police as sort of soldiers. I don't think that... And latterly, we had very little contact, the SNS, with the ordinary police. And Wingate, I think, rather shied away from the ordinary police. He kept his nose out of them and stuck it into the Jewish net, so he could get the information from them rather than the police. I don't think he trusted that the police, and I don't mean this unpleasantly, but I don't think he trusted that information he gave to the police would not find its way through the Arab side of that to the people, eventually to the wrong people. They might not tell themselves, they might tell friends in the villages, who might tell somebody else eventually the information. It was not a secure link, I think, for him.